You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today,
we do physics because we want to see cool things, right? This is a very, very quantum thing, right? It's not a classical thing. You never see this kind of thing on the classical world. I know it was predicted on paper, but now I can see it in a lab and it's like, wow, that's really pretty neat.
We're continuing our countdown of this year's biggest stories in physics.
This could have been number one for like the century. It still could, depending on what's going on. It came from somewhere else.
I'm Zia Morali. Welcome back to FQXI's rundown of the biggest physics stories of 2017, as chosen by quantum physicist Ian Durham of St. Anselm's College in New Hampshire. On the last edition, Ian gave us a few highlights of the year that didn't quite make his top five, including the production of metallic hydrogen, the formation of trianguline, and the discovery of a hidden chamber in an Egyptian pyramid using muons. Before we rejoin the conversation, this is just to say that our Skype connection does get a bit hairy for a few seconds along the way, but please stick with us because it does get back to normal pretty fast. So now, Ian, we have one more item that just missed out on a place in your top five. What was that?
I debated about this, and I thought, oh man, this really could have made my list. But then, I don't know, I had to make a choice. And they finally measured 3-photon interference. So we can do quantum interference with 2 photons fairly easily. We do it all the time. I do it in my own lab. Even though I'm a theorist, I have a lab where I do it. There's the, and I always butcher these names, the Hong-Ommendel effect. Hong-Ommendel interferometer is one that shows 2-photon interference, where you have 2 photons, and they pass through a beam splitter. If the photons are identical, they're going to arrive at the same time, and they can interfere, and they'll always exit sort of the same port of the beam splitter. But the thing is what they've been trying to do is figure out a way to do it with 3 photons, which is a little bit tricky. And a group of people at Oxford and at the University of Waterloo in Canada have managed to do this. They have 3 completely independent photons and 3 different sources. And then basically they're looking at coincidence counting. I do coincidence counting myself. And you're timing the arrival of photons at detectors. And if the photons arrive within a certain time frame, you were assuming that they were emitted from the same source. That's a really super simplistic way of saying it.
Okay, so I'm assuming that this confirms what we expected from quantum theory, but was there actually ever any possibility of getting a different outcome? So I'm thinking here about people talking about theories that go beyond quantum theory. There have been a lot of these kind of theoretical speculations. And I know there have been suggestions for higher order interference experiments that can maybe reveal if any of these alternative theories might be true.
So, okay, there are actually a number of questions wrapped up in that question. What they saw was exactly what they expected to see. This certainly supports the fact that our theories are correct, and that's good, right? What's interesting about it is that it was so hard to do experimentally because working with single photons and doing this stuff is very, very hard to do. It's so simple on paper, but it's so hard to do. Aligning lasers, especially when you're dealing with single photons, is incredibly difficult. It took me one entire semester once to align a particular laser. Now, you know, does it have any practical application? And the answer is, I don't know, maybe. It might have some practical application in quantum sensing, but that's not why we do physics. We do physics because we want to see cool things, right? This is a very, very quantum thing, right? It's not a classical thing. You never see this kind of thing on the classical world. So seeing this in a laboratory is just cool because you're like, wow, I know it was predicted on paper, but now I can see it in a lab and it's like, wow, that's really pretty neat.
Right, so we've gone through the things that didn't make it onto your list, and they were quite impressive. So let's see what actually has made it onto your list.
Okay, so number 5. So this was billed as particle-free quantum communication in a laboratory. That's a little bit misleading, but it's still a pretty amazing result. So what happened was 4 years ago, some theorists proposed a new quantum communication scheme based on the really simple idea of the wave-particle duality.
That simple idea.
Okay, so, well, it's simple in that they teach it to eighth graders, but nobody really understands it, right? You know, so everybody's heard of it, but nobody understands it. Anyway, this idea is that it uses the fact that the presence of an object blocking one arm of an interferometer created by basically a series of beam splitters and mirrors can actually be inferred by virtue of the fact that it sort of collapses the wave function of some photon somewhere else, even though there's no physical contact with the photon. There's a very famous example of this called the Elitzur-Wiedemann bomb test. And in the Elitzur-Wiedemann bomb test, in fact, I'm setting up a way to demonstrate this, not with real bombs, of course, in my lab. It's where you have a simple Mach-Zehnder interferometer and you send photons through and you have these theoretical bombs that are triggered by the presence of a single photon. And you put the bomb only in one arm of the interferometer. And the idea is that some of the bombs are bad and have bad triggers. And the question is could you determine the bad ones from the good ones and definitely sort them into saying, okay, I've got this factory and these I know are all good, these I know are all bad. And these are bombs that are triggered by a single photon. You can't just shine a photon on them because to see if they're working, because then they blow up. So you have to have some way of indirectly measuring that they're good. And the Elitzur-Wiedemann bomb test is one of those.
You know, you mentioned this Elitzur-Wiedemann bomb test. We should tell our listeners, we have a video, a very nice kind of popular video, and our video contest a few years ago, so they can go and actually watch it.
It's a great video.
It's nice. It's a little sort of fictional thriller that kind of sets this whole thing up, and a number of physicists we know are sort of acting in it, and it's a lot of fun.
Yes, Vladko Vedral stars in it and gets to drive in a fancy car and look like the dashing James Bond figure. It was a neat video. I was like, oh, I wish I were Vladko right there. But anyway. But yes, and he explains the whole thing about the bomb test experiment at the end. And this is very similar. It's a very similar kind of concept. So it relies a little bit on what's known as the quantum Zeno effect, which has to do with something called weak measurements.
What's a weak measurement? If you could just explain to us, what is a weak measurement?
Weak measurements are another way of measuring things without directly interfering with the thing you're measuring. So normally when you measure a photon, the only way to measure a photon, well, not the only way, but the way that we most commonly think of is we've got to absorb it into something. So you have the CCD chip or some kind of photon detector, your eyeball. The photon gets absorbed by whatever it is that you are using to make the detection with. The question is, can you detect the presence of a photon without actually absorbing it and, you know, finding that it's there, but then letting it go on its way? And that's kind of what weak measurements are all about. In the quantum Zeno effect, if you make a series of weak measurements, it can actually sort of stifle the quantum mechanical evolution of a quantum state. And it basically kind of makes it remain in its initial state. That's why it's called the quantum Zeno effect.
And just remind us what the normal non-quantum Zeno effect is.
Zeno's paradox was that, well, he had actually a whole bunch of paradoxes, but one of the more famous ones, the ones that this is sort of referring to, is you can never leave a room, for instance, right? Because in order to leave the room, you have to walk halfway to get out of the room. Well, once you've walked halfway, you now have to walk halfway between where you are and the exit again. And then you get to that halfway point, you got to walk halfway again, and you always have to walk halfway, and you run into this paradox, and you must never leave the room. So that's kind of the idea behind the quantum Zeno effect, is that by making little observations of it over and over and over again, you force it to remain in its state. So in this particular experiment, the protocol, which we always use Alice and Bob, which I always find funny because my mother-in-law's name is Alice.
Your father-in-law's not called Bob.
No, yeah. But I did have one of my best friends is named Bob. And Alice and Bob are the two communications people. That comes from an old paper from the late 70s. But Bob sends the message. Alice fires single photons at a chain of interferometers that's created by basically a series of beam splitters and mirrors. And at the output of the final interferometer, the photons end up in one of two detectors that's monitored by Alice. And Bob can choose whether or not to switch on a measuring device in the right-hand arm of each interferometer. And if Bob switches on his devices, he forces the photon that Al assent to behave as a particle, and it follows a definite path. So this is something that we know from the simple two-slit experiment. If you put a detector at one of the slits to figure out which slit a photon went through, you destroy the interference pattern. So it stops behaving like a wave and it starts behaving more like a particle, right? But the beam splitters are highly reflective, and so the photons are always reflected to the left. So Bob can use the quantum Zeno effect to cause the photon to remain in the left-hand channel as it goes through the apparatus, and as such it triggers Alice's right-hand detector. But then if he switches his devices off, the photon's wave function just evolves normally, and it ends up in a left-hand detector. So Alice can kind of learn of Bob's decision, whether or not he decides to turn on the devices, even though no photon passes between them, because the photon's always going the other direction. And that's kind of weird.
So, right, that was 4 years ago, the theory part. But what has happened now?
Now, what's interesting is this group in China has used it to actually send a picture across a room. It took forever, but it was like a picture. It was really kind of fascinating. They took a 100 by 100 monochrome bitmap of a Chinese knot, and it took 5 hours of transmitting 10,000 bits multiple times. They had to do this because of channel loss, right? So they've got to send each bit multiple times through because, I mean, photons are so easy to lose here and there. They just absorb and all that stuff. So to be sure that you got it, you've got to send a lot of runs through for each of the 10,000 bits. But they did that, and then they were able to reproduce the image about 87% of the time.
So the idea is that they haven't sent... So they're sending these photons through their experiment, but they're not directly sending them from... you know, to the place where they want the image to be reconstructed.
Exactly.
That reconstruction is happening sort of indirectly through sort of an inference.
Exactly. It's just like the Elitzur-Wiedemann bomb test experiment, where you can determine if the bomb is a working bomb without actually interacting with it. Just you can infer it because of the way the photons behave in the interferometer. And so they're doing that for each bit. They can infer whether the bit is a 0 or a 1 based on, you know, how the photons are behaving in the interferometer, even though they're not transmitting any photon between Alice and Bob.
And so when we have this name Wiedemann, is this the same Lev Wiedemann who wrote something after this whole thing was suggested 4 years ago?
Yes.
There's a bit of controversy here because I think he doesn't like it that much.
Yes. So Lev Wiedemann, who I actually saw this summer... the group published their results in Physical Review Letters, which is a pretty prominent journal.
So this is the theory group, we should say. So this was, you know, 4 years ago, and this was sort of people at Texas A&M University and the King Abdulaziz City for Science and Technology.
Yes.
In Saudi Arabia. So this was, he was writing a comment in response to the theory part rather than the experiment. Yep.
That's true. Yes, that's correct. He was writing in response to the theory part. And he sent a comment to the journal arguing that the photons would not pass between Alice and Bob only when Bob switches his devices on. He said with the devices off, you could have a weak measurement that could reveal photons to be present in the channel. It's kind of like this, right? We're used to when you turn a light off, the room goes dark almost immediately. But don't you ever wonder, what happened to those photons that were in that room? Where'd they go? Right? They went somewhere. Yeah, the room suddenly got dark because the light's not emitting photons anymore. But that doesn't mean all the photons are gone. And that was kind of Wiedemann's point. And so he said you could maybe do a weak measurement. An eavesdropper could do a weak measurement to maybe uncover a portion of the message being transmitted, which is an absolutely valid criticism, but I don't think it necessarily questions the concept behind it, right? I think it's maybe questioning whether it could be secure or not, but I don't think it questions the physics behind it, because it's basically doing the same thing that Lev himself had suggested in his bomb test experiment.
And also worth mentioning that the Chinese experiment was led by Junhui Pan, who is an FQXI member, and I think has been mentioned on our end of year lists before, if not last year, the year before. He seems to be doing a lot of good stuff that, you know, is the highlight of every year, it seems.
I know, and I'm jealous. I'm jealous. But I get to talk about him every year anyway, so...
And before you move on, in keeping with some of the things that have gone before, I guess he's mentioned himself that one use of this could be to image ancient art that can't be exposed to direct light.
Yes, and I work with people in the fine arts department, and they do a lot of art conservation stuff, and that's a big concern. In fact, there's a very famous museum in Boston called the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, and it's very dark. Part of that was, that's written into Isabella Stewart Gardner's will, but part of it is also to protect the artwork, because light degrades the artwork. And it would be nice to be able to image these things without actually passing any photons through, because even if you do it with x-rays or something, you're still passing photons through it. And it would be nice if there was a way to do it without actually interfering with it with photons. And this might be one way to do that. I'm not sure how you'd practically do it, but, you know, it certainly sounds cool.
But is it as cool as the story you have at number four, which is, you know, it's got the potential there to be...
Well, this could have been number one for, like, the century. It still could, depending on what's going on. But if you're paying attention to the news or anything, you may have heard of Oumuamua, which is the first rock in outer space that we have confirmed did not originate in this solar system. It came from somewhere else. It's a long cigar-shaped chunk of rock that, based on its trajectory, they determined could not have possibly originated in our solar system and must have come from somewhere else.
So I actually, you sent me this article from the Washington Post about this by Ben Guarino, and I just really like this little description he had about the trajectory. He says... planets and asteroids circle the sun on the same plane like water swirling around a basin, Oumuamua, dipped into the solar system from outside the plane, as if leaked from a cosmic faucet, which I just thought was a lovely image there.
It is kind of a nice image. I will say there, while most things do orbit the sun in a plane, there are a few things that are out of the normal plane of the ecliptic, so it's not all that unusual. But yes, this is kind of odd where it came from. And it's traveling pretty darn fast, too. 196,000 miles an hour.
And currently there are a number of groups, including one of the groups at SETI, who are looking at it to see, gee, maybe is there something on it? Could it be an alien structure? My guess is that it's just a rock. But one of the interesting things is that it lacks the characteristics of a comet. It's not an old comet core. Those are usually spherical. This is in the shape of a cigar, which, by the way, if any of you listeners have ever read the Arthur C. Clarke book, Rendezvous with Rama, it was a little bit like Rendezvous with Rama, where this giant sort of cigar-shaped cylindrical spaceship shows up out of nowhere. Anyway, this, of course, is not a spaceship. I think it's just a rock. Nevertheless, there are a lot of scientists who are looking at it. You know, maybe it'll tell us some things about what other solar systems are like.
So, you know, one of the a group that are studying at this Breakthrough Listen project, mm-hmm. you know, set up by Yuri Milner, and I think we talked about that last year, maybe, when it was set up.
We talked about Yuri Milner's projects a couple of times. Yuri likes to give money to a lot of places. I'd love it if he gave me money, but... Anyway.
But yeah, so while we were kind of preparing for this conversation, I got a press release from them in, and it's sort of breaking news. So you'd been saying that, you know, things could change any minute, and we have got an announcement from them. They have been studying this mysterious object. But so far, sad to say, no evidence of artificial signals emanating from the object so far detected by the Green Bank Telescope, but monitoring and analysis continue.
I don't want to get anyone's hopes up, because I do think it's a rock, but I will just say that there were no signals coming from Rama either in Arthur C. Clarke's book. So that doesn't necessarily mean there's nothing there.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it, because I haven't read this story, but does this end happily or sadly, should I ask?
You haven't?
I haven't read it, no.
Oh, wow. So it's a whole series. There are four books. Arthur C. Clarke wrote the first one, and then the last three were co-written. The last three are a little bit of a deviation from the first one. The first one is a really good, it's a classic science fiction novel from like the 50s. Really a good book. Worth a read. It stands well on its own. If you read the whole series is a little bit different than the original, but it's one of the classic sci-fi series. I thought they were going to make it into a movie here one of these days, but you know, the ship that they put humanity on in Interstellar kind of looked like Rama. It was a long cylinder, rotating cylinder. I think they may have gotten the idea from that.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll go away and read that immediately.
Yes.
I think. I feel quite shamed now that I haven't. So. Yeah. And on that embarrassing note, we'll take another break while I go and quickly read Rendezvous with Rama. So congratulations to the groups behind Three Photon Interference, Particle Free Quantum Communication, and I guess the asteroid Oumuamua itself for making its way here. In our final edition to be uploaded soon, we'll hear Ian's top three picks of the year, including...
which was this way to allegedly break time symmetry by sort of oscillating indefinitely without any energy input. Doctor Who immediately comes to mind. You get some really amazing stuff going on, but it's due to really sort of like this pure math kind of idea.
And?
Oh yeah, and I think it's going to revolutionize astronomy.
In the meantime, thank you again to Ian Durham for joining me. You can email us at podcast@fqxi.org or reach us on Twitter at FQXI or on Facebook at FQXI Physics. And as always, you can find out more about each of our picks on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. I'm Zia Morali.